This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is not an election. We shouldn't call it one. It's a coronation of a long-time dictatorship where people's rights have been deliberately eroded.
That was Professor Kweku Nuama, senior professional lecturer on peace, human rights, and cultural relations at American University in Washington, D.C., on Monday's election in Rwanda. Details coming up. Also, the combination of climate change and a growing world population may threaten global food security. And U.S. President Joe Biden says he is committed to pursue re-election despite questions about his mental state. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. President Paul Kagame, 66, has been the de facto leader of Rwanda since the end of the genocide in 1994. He officially became president in 2000 and has won three consecutive elections with landslide victories, securing over 90% of the votes each time. In 2015, he led the passage of a controversial constitutional amendment that allowed him to bypass the constitutional term limit and possibly stay in power until 2034. Professor Kweku Nuama, senior professorial lecturer on peace, human rights, and cultural relations at American University in Washington, D.C., says, next Monday in Rwanda, there will not be an election. Rather, he says, there will be a coronation.
So this is not an election. We shouldn't call it an election. The bar is very low in Africa because even places where we have genuine elections, they tend not to lead to real change. And so we are calling this an election. It's an insult to everybody that believes in democratic governance and institutional change and renewal through credible elections. This is not an election. We shouldn't call it one. It's a coronation of a long-time dictatorship where people's rights have been deliberately eroded. There is no opportunity to advance any debate on the social contract through democratic means. There is no opportunity to peacefully change the government. It's a one-man dictatorship. Kagame thinks he's going to develop that country, and you can give him credit for economic development and bringing stability, but you cannot give him credit for democracy because he doesn't believe in democracy. And maybe it's a bargain that the people who accept. But we don't really know what people in Rwanda think of Kagame, because you cannot have expression of opinions under dictatorship. We don't know whether people like Kagame or not. We only find out once he's out of office what people actually think of him. Right now, if you ask anybody, they'll all say they love him and he's a wonderful guy. But once a dictator is in power, you can never accurately evaluate how popular he is.
You are right, Professor. Paul Kagame has been accused of ruling the landlocked country in a climate of fear, stifling dissent and freedom of speech. But the big elephant in the room, Professor, is the election is happening at a time when there is rising tension between Rwanda and neighboring DRC. Congolese officials say he is sowing chaos in eastern Congo by supporting rebel forces.
So I don't want to put all of Congo's problems at Rwanda's door. Yes, Rwanda is a bad actor in the region. They support rebels, Tutsi, Banyamulenge rebels in the eastern part of DRC, and they destabilize that country for all kinds of reasons. But the onus is on the government in Kinshasa. This is their country. They have the resources. They have the primary responsibility of defending their state against rebels. And Rwanda's argument is that the government in the DRC is also supporting rebels who destabilize Rwanda. So they have two arguments, that the government is supporting rebels against them, and then the government is also unable to do activities in the Kivus, and that creates a bigger problem for the region. So if you can maintain security in your country, we're going to come in and do it for you. So, but as I said, the DRC is the biggest country in the region. It potentially is one of the richest countries in all of Africa and probably, you know, in the world as well. They need to get their act together. They need to manage their security. This week, we've seen the DRC government actually putting some of their own soldiers on trial for abandoning the fight against the rebels. And so that's their problem. That's their primary responsibility. It's not Rwanda's job to maintain security over there.
And in all fairness, Paul Kagame has accused the Congolese authorities of supporting the Hutu rebels who fled after committing the genocide in 1994. So this thing goes both ways.
And Uganda, too. Don't forget Uganda. Uganda has also been mentioned by the United Nations for also playing a role in that conflict.
That was Professor Kweku Nuama, Senior Professorial Lecturer on Peace, Human Rights and Cultural Relations at American University, speaking with me here in Washington, D.C. The United Nations reports both delegations of Sudan's warring parties have turned up for a second day of UN-mediated ceasefire talks in Geneva aimed at protecting and providing humanitarian assistance to millions of civilians devastated by the conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The talks got off to a rocky start Thursday when one of the delegations failed to show up. Without revealing which party stayed away, UN spokesperson in Geneva, Alessandra Vellucci, confirms they now are underway. What is important, she says, is that senior representatives from both the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces have accepted the invitation of the Secretary General's personal envoy, Ramtane Lamamra, to continue the discussions today. They were involved in separate proximity talks with Lamamra's team.
We urge them to participate because, as you all know, I mean, we've also spoken about this here on this podium, the humanitarian situation in Sudan is deteriorating by the day. So we really need to look at the devastating impact that this has on the civilian population. And we urge the delegations to rise up to this challenge and engage in constructive discussions.
Since rival generals triggered the conflict in mid-April 2023, the United Nations reports nearly 19,000 people have been killed, 33,000 injured, 12.7 million displaced, and some 18 million people are suffering from acute hunger. Vellucci says the Sudanese delegations are not meeting face-to-face, but are engaging in so-called proximity talks with the UN mediator, who shuttles between the two delegations.
The two delegations are comprised of senior representatives, that's what I can tell you, who have been delegated by the leaders of the warring parties to participate in the talks. And the delegations are composed of humanitarian, security and military experts. So that's what I can tell you about the delegations and the delegation level.
The UN spokesperson says she does not know how long the talks will last. She says what is important is that the warring parties identify and agree on ways to protect and assist the civilian population, possibly by agreeing on local ceasefires. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The combination of climate change and a growing world population may threaten global food security. Experts say crop yields could decrease by 30%, while the world's population could surge to over 10 billion. As the UN marks World Population Day, Mohamed Yusuf reports that changes in agriculture, especially in Africa, may be the only way forward.
The global population is expected to grow over the next 60 years, from 8.2 billion today to 10.3 billion in the 2080s. Much of that growth will occur in Africa, where many countries will have high fertility rates. The United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, says climate change is expected to exacerbate global inequalities and trigger national and international migration. UN agencies say 1 billion of the 1.3 billion people living in Africa struggle to afford healthy diets, and hunger worsened between 2019 and 2022. Africa's farmland has been shrinking because of persistent drought, while the growing population leave less space to farm. Chris Ojiwo is a principal scientist at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center. He says African farmers need to produce a lot of food in small spaces to feed the growing population.
We cannot even think of a human way or ethical way to stop population growth, so let it grow. But let us be able to produce more within a small area. For example, where we are able to produce only 1 ton of maize, let's say per hectare, why don't we work, and that's what we are doing, to improve this productivity to go beyond 1 ton to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 10 tons per hectare, considering developing varieties, but also production systems that enable us to be able to produce in intensified system on one hand, but also to be able to produce even when there is drought.
Speaking at a conference this week in Mexico, Anne Vaughan, Deputy Assistant Administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, said that scientific research and technology can help farmers cope with climate change and assist them in cultivating diverse crops.
To help make sure we're accelerating smart innovations so that farmers are getting access, so even in the face of pretty horrific drought, they're still able to produce food for themselves and their families. And what that looks like is making sure we have the right science, the right seeds, the right private sector partners who are pulling and creating a demand for these types of seeds, diversifying so you're not just growing maize, but you're growing cowpea and other things that are more resilient to climate change, the right type of practices so that you're mixing and intercropping, having less till.
The U.S. government launched Feed the Future in 2010, an initiative aimed at addressing the causes of hunger and poverty in developing countries worldwide. The program improved African agriculture system by promoting sustainable practices that consider climate challenges, that help increase economic opportunities, employment and trade. In some African countries, the dominance of maize crops as the primary source of food has worried experts. The crop relies on rain, and climate change is causing unpredictable rainfall patterns. Ogiowo says African farmers must change when and what they grow to produce enough food.
Ensuring that production and productivity continues, whether it is in-season or off-season, not necessarily relying 100% on rain-fed agriculture. And the diversification that I mentioned here also is not over-relying on one single crop for population survival. I know many countries are relying on either maize or something of that sort in terms of cereals, and ignoring some of the other crops that would fit into these systems.
Due to increasing drought in several African countries, farmers are urged to cultivate crops such as cassava, sorghum, pigeon peas, and pearl millet, which are resilient to unpredictable and harsh weather conditions. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. President Joe Biden fielded reporters' questions for nearly an hour yesterday, with detailed answers on foreign policy, with a full-throated defense of his resolve to continue running for president despite questions about his mental state. Biden spoke at the end of the NATO summit in Washington, where leaders agreed to concrete moves to bolster Ukraine's ability to fend off Russia's aggression. White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
President Joe Biden knew that this, a media appearance before a hungry press barraging him over his political future, would be a major challenge. It was preceded by a major wobble just minutes earlier, in which he introduced Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky by his nemesis name.
And now I want to hand it over to the president of Ukraine, who has as much courage as he has determination. Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin. President Putin. You can beat President Putin. President Zelensky, I'm so focused on beating Putin, we got to worry about it. Anyway, Mr. President,
I'm better.
You are a hell of a lot better.
On Thursday, at the end of a packed day of meetings at the NATO summit, Biden took questions for nearly an hour and attempted to soar above his recent rhetorical stumbles and focus on what he sees as the biggest challenge of his presidency, supporting Ukraine against Russia's onslaught. he took credit for what he described as success.
During the week of this summit, several heads of states made it a point in their statements to thank the United States and to thank me personally for all that NATO has achieved.
But he also acknowledged the challenge the American presidential race has become after his disastrous debate performance last month. He described his poor performance then as a stupid mistake, but reiterated his belief that he will beat former President Donald Trump in November.
I think I'm the most qualified person to run for president. I beat him once, and I will beat him again.
Questions about Biden's ability to stand up to major global challenges have been a whispered undertone of the Washington summit, marking the 75th year of the NATO alliance. Alliance members have made several concrete moves to shore up Ukraine, including a plan to bring coordination of the conflict under the purview of NATO instead of Washington. And publicly, many leaders have dismissed the doubts over Biden's fitness. Finnish President Alexander Stubb.
I have absolutely no concerns about the capacity of the current president of the United States to lead his country and to lead our fight for Ukraine and to lead NATO. And I think this summit speaks tons and volumes for that.
Some analysts seem to agree. William Galston is an analyst at the Brookings Institution.
I think it was a good day for Mr. Biden, the best day he's had in quite some time. Will it change the course of the stream, or will it just be a stone in the stream that diverts the current without fundamentally changing its course? I don't know.
On Friday, Biden faces another grueling test. He returns to the campaign trail with a visit to Detroit, where he will court the people whose approval he needs most. Voters. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
If Biden is not the Democratic Party nominee, who would be? VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at some of the contenders.
President Joe Biden says he's in this race to win.
I think I'm the most qualified person to run for president.
Following his debate struggles late last month, some leaders of his party are calling on Biden to step down as the presumptive Democratic nominee. But after months of voter primaries and caucuses, the Democratic Party cannot force him out, says University of Virginia Center for Politics Director Larry Sabato.
There is only one way for a nominee to be removed, and that is for the nominee to decide not to run before the convention, to open it up, to let the, in this case, Democratic National Committee set the rules for the convention.
If Biden does step down, Vice President and running mate Kamala Harris would top the list of Democrats to replace him. Harris says Biden is the party's nominee and demonstrated her loyalty by sliding Trump, who has split from his former Vice President Mike Pence.
Note, between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, only one candidate on that stage has the endorsement of his own Vice President. Joe Biden.
Harris, as the party's presidential nominee, might help with independent voters, says University of Southern California political science professor Christian Gross.
The one thing with Kamala Harris that I think makes her a little bit more electable than Biden right now is if you look at the polling, there's more independents who are undecided about her. So she can persuade people in a way that Biden maybe can't persuade people to move.
Also on the completely unofficial list of people who might replace Biden is California Governor Gavin Newsom. He too says he's backing Biden and showed his support campaigning for the president's re-election in Michigan last week. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is among those discussed as a possible Biden replacement. She too says she's still backing the president. Whitmer won re-election in an important swing state and is popular with national Democrats for supporting labor unions and efforts to combat gun violence. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear is less known nationally than Newsom or Whitmer, but he is a popular governor in a southern region dominated by Republican politics. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker hosts this year's Democratic convention and has the personal wealth to self-finance much of what would be a last-minute presidential run. And then there's former First Lady Michelle Obama, who has consistently rejected any notion of running for office, but who remains popular with many voters. A Reuters Ipsos poll last week showed Biden and Trump in a tie, but Michelle Obama beating Trump by more than 10 percentage points. Sabato says there's no way she's running.
She's much too smart after 8 years in the White House to want to go back, much less to be president. So, you know, we could speculate about names all night long. But what matters is who has the intense ambition, the ability to raise money, and the opportunity to put together the kind of coalition that could produce a majority in the convention.
If Biden stays in the race, that speculation about other names may carry on through next month's Democratic Party convention in Chicago. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And in our sports segment, we have VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Barrow in the studio. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Yehez.
So, Sunday, big day, UEFA Euro 2024 and Copa America 2024 finals on Sunday. What teams have made it so far?
So, for the UEFA Euro 2024, Spain will be going up against England. And for Copa America 2024, it will be Argentina versus Colombia. So, you know, as we know, we have some huge fans of the English national team all across Africa. Some are screaming, it's coming home, but it's not coming home to Africa. It's coming home to England. We shall see how that goes. But let's just look at some of the semifinal games that they were able to play. So Spain went up against, you know, a formidable opponent in France and were able to beat them 2-1. Mm-hmm. And England were able to beat the Netherlands 2-1 as well. So similar scores. The games were a little bit different in that Spain has been the most dominant team in this tournament. England has just found a way to win simply by the quality of their players. Maybe not so much tactically, but they have so many different players at their disposal, and we will definitely see a heavyweight clash on Sunday. Now, as for Copa, you have Argentina versus Colombia. Colombia, to me, I feel like has had a stronger tournament with James Rodriguez as arguably the player of the tournament. He's been assisting, and he has been scoring goals as well. But, you know, you cannot count out the 2022 World Cup winners with Lionel Messi at the helm as the captain. So going up against them, this will also be another heavyweight fight. So I'm excited. Sunday is going to be a day where you just sit down and watch.
And another sports extravaganza, the Paris Olympics 2024 coming up. And in that sports venue, the U.S. basketball team might be the best team ever assembled. Do you think so?
It has potential simply because of the names on this roster, right? When we think of the best U.S. Olympic team ever, we think the Dream Team, 92, with Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and the likes. But when you're thinking about this team, they have yet to be coined with a name yet, but you have the likes of LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, and then some of the young stars in Jason Tatum, as well as Anthony Edwards as well. So I definitely think this is a very well-stacked team, but the game has also evolved so much internationally that it's not going to be that easy for them to win. So we shall see.
And finally, Eritrean Binyam Girmay, Africa Cycling's new face. Talk to us about that. He has won, what, 3-stage Tour de France?
This is amazing because the first one, he was the first black cyclist to ever win any stage in the Tour de France. So the first one was kind of like, wow, this is unique. We've never seen it before. It might not happen again, what some people were thinking. He wins the second one and now the third. So now this is showing that he is somebody to be really looked at as one of the elite cyclists. And I'm really excited to see what this does for cycling moving forward on the continent, to have him be the face of cycling. Maybe we start building more infrastructure to assist and no longer have the game be somewhat of an elitist game, because can we get this game to the youth?
Amazing. It's just amazing. VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Barrow, thank you for your input.
Thank you for having me.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.